From California to South Carolina, Montana to Missouri, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, underfunding of the Social Security system is a looming problem, and Congress is unable or unwilling to agree on a fix. Jason Pye from FreedomWorks is here to talk about what needs to be done. Senate Democrats are queuing up increased taxes to pay for the big spending programs in their Green New Deal. Scott Hutchison of the Club for Growth has the real story. As e-cigarettes gain popularity, government regulators have stepped in. Eric Boehm talks with Liz Mayer about FDA policies on smokeless tobacco and vaping. And after 2 years of investigating, the Mueller report has exonerated President Trump. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says someone needs to be held accountable for putting the nation through that ordeal. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Both the Social Security system and Medicare are headed for fiscal distress, as each will be underfunded by trillions of dollars. Yet Congress has not been able to pass reforms that would place those programs on solid financial ground. Jason Pye is Vice President of Legislative Affairs for FreedomWorks. He is here to talk about the options facing lawmakers. Jason, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jason, Social Security is something that concerns many Americans, and a number of polls show that younger Americans in particular really don't have confidence that it's going to be there for them when they are ready to retire. So reform is something that needs to happen sooner rather than later. Can you, first of all, explain for us what sort of financial difficulties lie ahead for the Social Security system?
Social Security, in the immediate future, the Disability Insurance Trust Fund will face benefit cuts. The Old Age and Survivors, which is the retirement account, will face benefit cuts. I think those benefit cuts are supposed to happen in 2032 and 2034, respectively. So we're talking immediate concerns related to those programs. In total, the program faces about a $12 to $13 trillion unfunded liability over the next 75 years. That means it's scheduled to pay out $12 to $13 trillion more than it actually will receive in tax revenues over the next 75 years. It's a real problem, and Congress is going to have to eventually address this issue sooner rather than later. And I think the question is, how much pain is it going to, they're going to be when they actually do it? There's legislation pending in the House Ways and Means Committee that's really concerning to me, because it not only doesn't address the underlying issues of Social Security, it will make us worse off, because it raises taxes on every American and also strangely increases benefits at a time when most Americans are receiving more benefits from like a 401k. And Democrats seem to rest in this notion that Social Security is better than the private market, which is kind of concerning to me. But here we are, and this is what they're pushing.
As we look at what's happened over the years, Jason, we frequently hear that the federal government is borrowing, quote, quote, from the Social Security Trust Fund to finance the deficit spending that our country engages in. At what point are the dollars that were borrowed eventually repaid from regular tax revenue, or is that something that's frankly never going to happen?
Some of that money is supposed to start being paid back as early as next year, but I also think that it doesn't really matter right now in terms of it all. Social Security still, even if that money were to be repaid, Social Security still faces an unfunded liability. That's including any repayment that comes. So regardless of any of that stuff, Social Security will still have to be funded through general tax revenues, through the general budget, through general funds, because the program itself is not bringing in enough revenue. When Social Security was started back in 1935, that's when the legislation was passed. It didn't actually begin cutting checks until a few years later. There were more than 40 workers per retiree. 40 workers per retiree. Today, it's a little over two. This is a real problem, and we have to start figuring out ways to bolster the workforce. Now, that would involve something like bringing in high-skilled workers into the United States for them to work and pay FICA tax revenue, or other combinations of something like Sam Johnson introduced, Congressman Sam Johnson from Texas, who retired at the end of last term in Congress, but his bill sort of lives on. It's called the Social Security Reform Act. This bill actually saves Social Security, creates a $600 billion surplus in perpetuity over the next 75 years without raising a cent in taxes. And it does this by raising the retirement age. People like me will not be able to retire until I'm 69, but that's okay because the life expectancy these days is 79 years old, almost 80. That modest tweak, as well as other tweaks in the bill, would create this surplus and Social Security would be there for the next generation. It would supplement our private retirement funds.
You raise a good point there, Jason. In terms of Social Security, whenever Social Security was first enacted way back in the early part of the 20th century, average lifespans were much shorter than they are now. Yeah. We have better nutrition, better medical care now, and we thank God for that. But all of this is putting a stress on the Social Security system because now people are receiving benefits far longer than expected. So what is the resistance to a increase in the retirement age, a gradual increase in retirement age on younger workers, not people who are about to receive it now, but on younger workers who will have their entire working careers to plan for it? What is the nature of the opposition to that?
I mean, look, Democrats don't like it. Democrats, whenever there are, back in 2004, 2005, George W. Bush, he had just won re-election, and he said it, probably a little too boldly that he had political capital and he was going to spend it. And by spending his political capital, he wanted to allow workers to invest a little bit of their own money into a private retirement account. Now, we're all for that, 100% for that. But the Democratic response to that was they ran to the FDR Memorial in Washington, D.C., where they had a press conference and basically said, this is FDR's dream. We're not going to let the president change it. This would destroy Social Security as we know it. And whenever changes to Social Security are discussed, Democrats say that Republicans want to make seniors eat cat food. I'm not kidding. This is the stuff they actually say. And it's ridiculous, yet it's still effective because you have loud special interest groups like the AARP and others who demagogue this issue to scare seniors and to prevent anything from ever actually getting done with this program. It's not as big of a burden as Medicare is. Medicare is a $37.7 trillion unfunded liability, but it's one of two programs that are bankrupting our nation, and we have to address this problem sooner rather than later than playing petty politics to score cheap political points while screwing over taxpayers in the process.
Well, there's no doubt but what the Democrats and political campaigns use Social Security and, of course, taking away your health care as issues against Republicans. Unfortunately, it works quite well for them.
Yeah.
So I think we can expect to continue seeing that as we head into the future. So there are some proposals that would correct the system without massive tax hikes on individuals and businesses. We will see where all of that goes. In the currently divided Congress, we have been talking with Jason Pye, who is Vice President of Legislative Affairs for FreedomWorks. And Jason, tell us a bit about FreedomWorks and also where can folks go to learn more?
Well, first, you can go to learn more at freedomworks.org. You can also follow me on Twitter at Pye, P-Y-E. FreedomWorks is a grassroots organization dedicated to training and activating individuals on issues that promote free markets and individual liberty. Check us out at freedomworks.org.
Jason Pye of FreedomWorks. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Loma. Take care.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth. A couple of major policy matters perking through Congress. We're going to talk about them today. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's first of all, and I know folks' eyes glaze over when you say the words capital gains, but capital gains taxes have a real impact on the economy, on jobs. Democrats are once again looking at capital gains as a golden goose to help fund, among other things, the Green New Deal. Tell us what they're proposing now or what they're talking about now.
And, you know, when I hear capital gains, my eyes perk up and I start to get a little bit of excitement because what we really have there is people seeing increases in the investment and the risk-taking that they're doing in business investment. So, look, capital gains are a critical part of economic growth. What happened was Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, he's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, proposed a plan that would tax capital gains on long-term investments annually rather than when someone actually decides to sell their asset. So the gains that you accrue in your investments, you wouldn't even have to sell them. You would just be taxed on the gains on an annual basis, and that is certainly not the case currently. It would also, his proposal would raise current taxes on capital gains to match the rates on other types of income, such as salaries.
As we looked at the proposals for bigger government, specifically the so-called Green New Deal, not a single member of the Senate voted in the affirmative. A number of them voted present, whatever that means. Is this something that we're going to see Democrats go full tilt on in the presidential campaign that's coming up?
Well, I think we should certainly hold all those Democrats accountable for the reckless policy positions that they've taken within the Green New Deal. There are six Senate presidential contenders that have co-sponsored the legislation in the Senate, and that means that they need to own every single word on the page of the proposal. And, you know, I think what they'll try to do is say that they support certain elements of a Green New Deal and may have some presidential candidates talking more about Medicare for all, others talking about free college tuition for everybody, others talking about a living wage, a wealth transfer to those that are unwilling to work. Look, the Green New Deal would certainly be economic Armageddon for the American people, and I think that Mr. Wyden's tax plan on capital gains would help facilitate that economic Armageddon even quicker than just the Green New Deal on its own.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about health care. President Trump, of course, seems to have re-energized that debate. He was meeting with Republicans this past week. Can you give us an update on what's happening?
About a week ago, President Trump made an announcement that the Republican Party was going to be the party of great health care. Obamacare is a disaster, and it's far too expensive. Deductibility is ridiculously high and virtually unusable. So he's calling on the courts to agree and affirm what happened in the Northern District of Texas, where a district judge said that the law was unconstitutional now that the individual mandate has been zeroed out. And so there's an appeal process going forward with the U.S. Court of Appeals and the Fifth Circuit. And within 2 years, we think that that could certainly be back in the forefront at the Supreme Court. So in the meantime, what I think a lot of the conservative movement, the activist community, and conservatives on Capitol Hill are interested in doing is preparing underneath this assumption that the Supreme Court will rule the entire Obamacare law unconstitutional. When that happens, what do we have as an alternative to fill the vacuum? We certainly don't think here at Club for Growth that that alternative should be akin to Obamacare. It shouldn't be a giant, robust healthcare alternative. What we need to do is get back to the fundamentals in healthcare markets and restore a marketplace that really strives on competition. And one way to do that is to certainly allow for the purchase of health insurance across state lines. We want to also see a dramatic expansion of health savings accounts, putting more power back into the American people's ability to save for health care in a tax-free environment as a health savings account, and then to utilize the funding whenever they run into a situation where they need to draw into the account. President Trump has also achieved a couple of pretty solid free market reforms through executive action, and we think that a health care alternative should codify and make law those free market reforms. That means making short-term limited duration plans and association health plans permanent, and that would give Americans the ability to gain health care coverage that fits their needs, including high deductible and low monthly premium plans, and also allowing small business employers the ability to join together to purchase health insurance. I think that Republicans need to advocate for price transparency in healthcare, and they need to also take a look at the fundamental cost drivers in Obamacare, which are the really costly regulations that are built into the law with community rating and guaranteed issue. Now, there certainly needs to be some protection for folks with pre-existing conditions, and one option that's out there is to separate the pool of people that have pre-existing conditions from the healthier population and pay for a pre-existing high-risk pool population instead of putting them into the entire pool of healthcare coverage and having healthier people subsidize their costs of healthcare premiums. So we're not going to leave anybody behind, but I think that if you can separate the pool out and put it into another bucket, theoretically you would see a dramatic decrease in healthcare premiums for the American people and for families that need healthcare coverage.
And certainly this debate will continue, particularly as the 2020 presidential election heats up. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. And if your listeners are interested, they can check out our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually become a member of Club for Growth for free.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Vaping and smokeless tobacco have rapidly gained popularity, and so have caught the attention of regulators at the Federal Drug Administration. To learn more about their policies, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Liz Mayer. Eric?
You are listening to American Radio Journal. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us, folks. My guest today is Liz Mayer. She is a libertarian political strategist, and she works on a number of different issues, including tobacco regulations and tobacco alternatives, things like e-cigarettes, vaping, and snus. If you haven't heard of snus, that's okay. It's one of the things we're going to talk about today. She's also, interestingly enough, on the receiving end of a lawsuit, a very odd lawsuit from Representative Devin Nunes, who is suing Liz and some other people over some things that they said about him on Twitter that he doesn't like. It's a weird lawsuit, pretty obvious violation of the First Amendment, I think. We'll talk about that with her as well. Liz, you're obviously a very busy woman. We appreciate you taking a little bit of time out of your day to chat with us here. Thanks for being on the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
We're going to get to the Nunes lawsuit in a minute. I do want to ask you about that, but I want to start off with something that's probably actually much more important, even though you won't hear a whole lot about it on cable news, and that is what's going on at the FDA involving these sorts of tobacco alternatives, cigarette alternatives, things like e-cigarettes, things like snus. That's S-N-U-S. It's like a Swedish product, Swedish tobacco product. Scott Gottlieb is leaving the FDA, and he's going to be replaced there, and that's going to sort of shift the ground a little bit. But I guess we want to start with what Gottlieb has done on this front, because he's been a little bit inconsistent at times, and a little bit I've been kind of surprised by the way his FDA has handled e-cigarette regulations. Tell us a little bit about where the ground is there right now.
I think Gottlieb has a mixed record. So first of all, looking at it from the vapor and the e-cigarette side, obviously he has led this vapor crackdown, and that's something that my client Vapers United, Vapers as in V-A-P-E-R-S United, has been very vigorous in calling out and talking about. But on the other side of the coin, when you're talking about snus, and if people don't know what snus are, they should Google snus, he has actually overseen some pretty robust and good stuff on that front. I think it was between 4 and 6 weeks ago, you had an FDA scientific panel that more or less seems to have accepted the notion that, yes, you have a less harmful product here, and that should be conveyed to consumers. That's only fair. Gottlieb hasn't been as good as what people had hoped on vapor, although I think initially he did recognize the harm reduction potential. But then with regard to this other product, snus, he actually has been relatively good or has overseen a pretty good process. So then the question becomes what happens under his successor, Dr. Ned Sharpless, who looks like even more of a vapor hawk than what Gottlieb was, which is probably not good for the vapor industry. With regard to snus, we really don't know. So I think there are a lot of questions here is the upshot. And we don't really know where this is going, but it is something people should be watching because obviously it has huge impacts on public health. And of course, with more and more taxpayer funding of healthcare, the more people end up with emphysema or COPD or asthma or, God forbid, actual lung cancer, it's not just of concern to them, their family, their friends. It's actually of concern to all of us.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about public health. And just to go back to snus for a second, if people are unfamiliar with it, without going into a ton of detail here, it's a small nicotine-laced packet that you sort of put into your lip the way you would chewing tobacco, but it's not chewing tobacco. And this is wildly popular in Sweden, where it was originally developed. And coincidentally, or really not so coincidentally, Sweden has some of the lowest oral cancer rates and smoking death rates in the world. So it seems pretty obvious to me, Liz, as an outside observer, that there's sort of a continuum here between tobacco products or nicotine products that are less healthy and those that are relatively safer. There are obviously the risks involved with all of these things, but there's sort of a spectrum there. And it seems like maybe the FDA is finally acknowledging that in some ways, like with snus, but yet at the same time, the e-cigarette regulations now are treating those products basically the same as old style tobacco cigarettes. And so there seems to be this disconnect between the reality of that spectrum and the way the FDA is treating these things.
No, I agree. I think it's odd. I mean, look, I think snus is a product that's been around for like a couple hundred years, okay? And it's been studied and extensively researched. So there's a lot of data there, and there's a lot of data that makes really clear that it just does not have the harm potential that a whole range of other tobacco products do. It just doesn't. But with regard to e-cigarettes, yeah, you sort of had Gottlieb come in and be very bullish on the potential for e-cigarettes, but then he obviously has seen some data that he doesn't like pertaining to underage use of them, which, you know, I think generally people don't want underage people using things that are potentially addictive. I think we all get that. But that seems to have led him in the direction of this real vapor crackdown. And I think the risk here is, as you say, there's a harm continuum. And fundamentally, what people need is choices if they're not going to smoke or if they want to limit their harm. Also, just in general, there are a lot of people who hate e-cigarettes. I mean, big tobacco hates e-cigarettes, and frankly, so does big pharma. And so they have some very powerful enemies. And I think that's probably part of the story.
We are talking with Liz Mayer. She is a libertarian political strategist who works on a variety of issues up on the Hill. And Liz, just about a minute left here, but I have to ask before I let you go, you have recently been sued by a member of Congress, Devin Nunes, and he is unhappy with you and some other people on Twitter, one of whom, I believe one of these accounts purports to be his cow. This is all very strange. What is he trying to accomplish here?
I exercise my First Amendment rights is the simple answer. The First Amendment protects our right of free speech. It was specifically written to enable people to criticize their government. He is a sitting member of the House of Representatives, i.e. he is the government. I am not the government. I am a private citizen who admittedly has more of an audience than many private citizens do, but still less of one than what the government does. And I chose to point out some things in his record and with regard to his actions and his behavior. And I think he's unhappy about that. But the fundamental fact is he swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And I think pretty clearly that's not what he's doing, because he is not supporting and defending First Amendment rights here, which is what I'm exercising at the end of the day.
Well, I can't speak for the congressman, obviously, in this case, but we appreciate when you exercise your First Amendment right here on our program, Liz. Thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thank you. That's awesome.
And again, that is Liz Mayer. She is a political strategist in Washington, D.C. She does some great work, and we always appreciate having her here on the show. For Reason Magazine, I am Eric Boehm. You can check out the work that we are doing at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Congress has passed laws holding private individuals accountable for their actions. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says, "We need a similar law that will hold our elected officials responsible." Frank?
I don't know about you, but I've had it. After hijacking our nation and our citizens for the past 2.5 years, the Mueller report on the collusion of President Trump, his campaign, and the Russians has ended, with no discernible evidence of collusion and no decision on obstruction of justice. According to Attorney General Barr, the report will be released in mid-April 2019. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, James Comey, and others have held this nation hostage since the 2016 election. Someone must pay for this attempted overthrow of the government of the United States, or the very fabric of our republic will be torn to shreds. Decisions by government leaders have profound effect on a nation. Accountability by public officials is non-existent, and that must end now. No matter what the topic, it seems as if the offending public officials are given a pass and the citizens pay for this malfeasance. This lack of accountability must stop. Be it the debate on the Mueller investigation or in the record-shattering deficits, unfunded pension obligations, and virtually unlimited increases in health care costs, intelligence community and FBI overreach, the truth must finally be known and the guilty must be prosecuted. That elected officials are passing on tough decisions to future generations is irresponsible and embarrassing. the disastrous unintended consequences of financial decisions by elected leaders makes them all that much more responsible for their actions. Governments, however, are loath to make elected officials accountable for their decisions. It is absurd to think that the public is better served merely because an elected leader destroys our economy and our lives versus destroying a business. People's lives have been held hostage for the past 2 years, and the nation was never permitted the pleasure of celebrating a restoration of free markets and less government intervention because of the psychological narcissism of someone who lost the presidential election and the deep state's preoccupation with preserving itself at our expense. The irresponsibility of the fraud perpetrated on the American people, which triggered the Mueller investigation, unfunded health insurance bill, unfunded Social Security mandates, unfunded pension obligations, unfunded medical plans, unsubstantiated and unwarranted pork, and record deficit spending all contribute to the potential bankrupting of our nation and our way of life. Rightfully, Enron, WorldCom, and other business scandals caused a public outcry and led to the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Sarbanes-Oxley was intended to improve governance and reduce the likelihood of fraud. It made certain that actions by the chief financial officers, chief executive officers, and board members became subject to criminal prosecution. In light of the clamor of the unfunded Trump collusion, it's shocking that government has never held itself accountable to the public for its actions. Our nation spent untold resources to placate the ego of a fallen politician and a deep state threatened. We were almost overthrown as a government. Because of the government's failure to regulate itself, I propose a bill to protect the American people from the improper actions of elected leaders. Such a bill would establish the same type of trust and accountability upon elected officials as we have come to expect of business leaders. I'd call it the Public Responsibility and Trust Act, and that would require, in the case of conviction or proven liability, any improper or fraudulent actions by elected officials be dealt with personally and paid for from their own assets. Those assets would have already been disclosed in the ethics filings required by those people. Such improper actions would include things such as misuse of office in violation of the public trust, self-dealing and insider trading on information gleaned while in office, failing to account for public funds and passing unfunded mandates, using public funds for any financial supporter to support a candidate's campaign without a full ethics disclosure and review of the action, failing to implement a system of internal controls over financial reporting of any governmental entity, waste, fraud, and abuse to include pork-type projects without a cost-benefit analysis by such groups as the Congressional Budget Office or the independent fiscal offices of the various states. Finally, it would require the president, vice president, all political appointees, members of the House of Representatives, and the Senate to certify that they have complied with the provisions of this act. If you find this demand harsh, it is merely the same certification required of corporate executives and physicians this nation under the Sarbanes-Oxley bill and the medical reimbursement systems. If prison is appropriate for Bernie Madoff, it is the proper destination for those who abuse the public trust. The nation has not been well served by the people whose only risk is to be voted out of office. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KKIM-AM and KXKS-AM in Albuquerque, New Mexico, along with KERI-AM in Bakersfield, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.